Happy Bitcoin Wednesday, freaks. It's your boy Odell here for another Citadel Dispatch. I know it's been a long time coming since our last proper dispatch. I've missed you, freaks. I've hoped you missed the show as well. Have been going through some family situations, so I am out of the studio. But I'm using this as an opportunity to get some great guests in via remote. And this show will be the start of that. Before we get started, of course, Citadel Dispatch is 100% funded by you guys. It's 100% audience funded with no sponsors and no ads. I appreciate all the support I've been getting from you all. The easiest way to contribute to the show is through Podcasting 2.0. There are multiple Podcasting 2.0 apps. Some of my favorites are Breeze, Fountain, and Podverse.fm. You simply download the app. You load it up with sats. You search Citadel Dispatch and you press subscribe. Then you choose how many sats per minute you think the show is worth to you, and it will automatically stream sats directly to my Lightning node as you listen. It's extremely empowering seeing all the sats come in every day, and I really do appreciate all the support. You can also support the show through something called Boostergrams on Podcasting 2.0, where you do a one lump sum payment and you attach a message to that. As is tradition, I will read some of the highest boostergrams that Dispatch has received since our last show. We have CA Danner with 50,000 sats saying, always learning something new, even if most too technical for an artist. So here's my shameless plug. Happy to have 10 paintings keeping you company at Bitcoin Park, Matt Odell. We are fortunate enough, as CA Danner said, to have a bunch of her paintings on display and for sale at Bitcoin Park in Nashville. We also have we have at Bon with 7,779 sats saying boost chain continues. Matt's explanations on KYC and expanding on privacy is not secrecy was perfect. Well said and articulated that far into the pod and bottle. Appreciate everything you do. Enjoyed listening to this one guy. This one guy's thanks. And then we have Bonsco with 16,969 sats hitting the boost button for the first time. Thanks for going over these hot button topics. Also, I like the way Odell says button. So you're welcome. I said button again. You can also support the show by going to CitadelDispatch.com. I have a BTC pay server there. You can pay on-chain or Lightning. I also have a pay name. That's Odell. Very easy to remember. It's linked to at CitadelDispatch.com as well. And we are in a bear market. So if you do not have sats to spare, one of the easiest ways to support the show is to subscribe on your favorite platforms. Dispatch is available on all podcast apps. You just search Citadel Dispatch. Pressing that subscribe button, pressing that auto download button really does help the show. Leaving a good review or a bad review, any kind of reviews are always helpful. I'm not going to tell you how to leave a review. Dispatch is also available on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, and we have our Matrix chat, which you can access by going to CitadelDispatch.com, including that Citadel chat button. As always with Dispatch, we love our live audience. So thank you to all of you who continue to join us live. That live chat is piped in from Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, and Matrix, allowing us to address your comments and questions while we are live on the show. It makes it a truly unique experience. With all that said, I want to keep this introduction really tight because we do have a great show and we do have a bit of a time constraint. We're going to limit this one to at least, at the very most, an hour and a half, but we're going to do a lot of really good topics here. And I'm fortunate enough to have return guest, an absolute legend, Adam, back here. How's it going, Adam?
Yeah, pretty good. Never a dull day in Bitcoin land.
Never a dull day. That's for sure. I guess before we get started, you just got back from Riga from the Baltic Honey Badger. How was that experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a couple of years, but always one of my favorite conferences, kind of, you know, very Bitcoin focused. The HODL team who puts it on does a good job of kind of curating what kind of topics they want to see. And so they keep it informative and, you know, some technical tracks and a kind of medium size, you know, so not too large, not too small in terms of attendee counts. And so it's a good place to have lots of conversations and see people.
I love the size. It's like the ideal size. It's like 500 people.
Yeah, that's great.
It's like a nice balance between a small event and a large event. Super high signal. I was there in 2019. Truly a special experience. They do put on a good show. I was really disappointed that I had to drop out last minute due to family. But I will say I was not surprised to hear all the good words after the fact. I had massive FOMO. I think it, at least the 2019 one, and from what I've heard was similar this year. I think it's the single best event of the year. It's a truly special experience, and Riga is just a really, really fantastic city.
Yeah, well, it's good to go back there anyway.
So Adam, we have many topics that I'd love to go over with you. But first and foremost, a topic that has been a major discussion on Dispatch, partly because it feels like a lot of other shows don't want to touch it, because it is a bit of a sensitive topic, is since I last had you on, we had this Tornado Cash sanction event where they sanctioned a smart contract on Ethereum that provided privacy to users, and they targeted the developers. They took the code off of GitHub, which is a centralized platform that hosted the code. It's owned by Microsoft. And they arrested one of the developers in the Netherlands. I mean, while we have you on, I'm so grateful to have you on. I mean, you were involved in the crypto wars of the 90s, which I personally think has never really ended. It's just continued. And I'm curious on your thoughts here about the Tornado Cash situation, similarities with the export controls put on PGP in the 90s, and how you think this, like, how does, obviously this is an Ethereum tool, but how do you think this impacts all the work being done on Bitcoin?
Well, it's certainly not a good direction. In terms of similarities, there are a little bit of similarity with the trouble that Phil Zimmerman had for a period of time when he got investigated for, I guess, exploiting the implementation of encryption in PGP, which was export restricted at that time and isn't really in an effective way. You know, effectively, the rules changed some years ago now. But, you know, nevertheless, the concept that a government or justice system could make an order telling somebody to, you know, unpublish code or modify code is a bit of legal adventurism, I would say. And I saw Coin Center, you know, pushing back against that strongly and looking to contest that. Now, I think the other thing is that sort of you don't want a bad legal precedent of something to stand. And, you know, effectively the legal process itself, you know, I'm not legally qualified by any means, but just observing, it seems to be a bit chaotic with, you know, the general sort of combative nature of common law that, you know, the prosecution throws all manner of claims and the defense has got to, like, you know, try and counter or whittle them down. And you've got to assume that just as a matter of course, the prosecution knows full well that most of the claims are exaggerated or outright false. And it's just a way to, you know, land somewhere. And unfortunately, at least in the US, there seems to be a lot of attempts to sort of plea bargain so that somebody would agree to something that doesn't really make a lot of sense, but they just want it to end from their own perspective, right? And that's kind of a recipe to get to a bad precedent. So I'm certainly hopeful that Coin Center and others put some effort into, you know, prevent to sort of pushing back on a bad precedent getting developed here.
So, I mean, at the core of this argument is that in America, speech is protected and code is speech. That was the core of the argument back in the 90s. Am I correct? Were you the one who printed the T-shirts with the RSA code on it?
Yeah, that was me. Actually, recently, Blockstream did a rerun. So they published the old T-shirt or a small modification of it, just for kind of historic purposes, but I guess kind of topical to this development. And you know, I mean, at the time, the point of that bit of code was to sort of say, you know, what's the distinction between, you know, electronic publication and print publication or speech, and a t-shirt is a kind of, you know, something that's small enough to print on a t-shirt is kind of silly to, you know, have speech restrictions on or writing restrictions on, none of which kind of really are make sense in the US context. Now, of course, the Tornado Cash is more international in flavor, and I don't know the specifics of the Netherlands, but I think another factor which you saw with there was an Ethereum fellow who got himself tangled up in North Korea somehow, that you never know, you know, what I guess some of the accusations are, you know, not public at this stage, and you know, from the outside we won't know what's going on exactly, but sometimes it can get sort of blurred where, you know, maybe the person did something semi-related that is actually what got them in trouble more than, you know, the issue at hand, which is of concern to the wider Bitcoin ecosystem.
Right. I mean, the particular case you're talking about was Ethereum core developer Virgil Griffith, which, you know, maybe code was a portion of that situation, but ultimately he went to North Korea, and I believe the allegation, at least, is that he gave a seminar to North Koreans on how they could use it to evade sanctions, which is strictly illegal in America, at least.
Right. Well, maybe, I think other countries too. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe there's a. You're basically saying that potentially there's something that we don't know about the Tornado Cash case. It's not just related to the code.
Right. I mean, it could be because, I mean, I think prosecutors generally is a pen, you know, because it varies by country. But hang on a second. I think my connection is not very good.
I still hear you. You sound good over here.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. So, yeah, I mean, it's it varies by country a bit, but, you know, I think we won't know exactly if there's some other issue behind it. And I think prosecutors tend to like to, you know, pick cases where they think they have a reasonable chance of winning. And so, you know, some kind of combination case where somebody does something that's kind of clear cut, plus something they would like to push, you know, push the envelope on, then they tend to pick those, which is kind of unfortunate for our perspective.
So they can get some kind of legal precedent there. So there's two elements here. One element is from what I take from what you're saying is that this should be fought in court. And you think that at least the code side, based on what happened in the 90s, the code side should be considered protected speech in America. And that should be defended in court and will probably be upheld.
I mean, I certainly hope so, you know. And I think that, you know, I think people in the justice system sometimes lose track of who they work for. I mean, basically, they're there to, you know, enforce societal norms, not to get into misadventures of, you know, eroding civil liberties and changing the balance of society. So I hope that's... that is prevented here.
So, I mean, yeah. So that is one side. What do you say to? I mean, there's a group of Bitcoiners, and I mean, there was a portion of the cypherpunks before Bitcoin even existed that believe that we should be building systems outside of state control, outside of the legal system. Do you believe this is a dual pronged front? Like you build the tools, you use the tools, but also you fight it legally through the necessary channels?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you have to, I mean, I'm also a fan of the kind of publish anonymously phenomena and have a decentralized system, which is, you know, the effect that Bitcoin has, because it's not really possible for, you know, somebody to sue Bitcoin. I mean, where would you start, right?
Right.
And that's one of its strengths. And of course, the, you know, the fact that Satoshi stayed anonymous, stepped away, you know, many years ago now. And, you know, so there's not really anything in the way of a hierarchy or identifiable control point, I think is beneficial. So in a way, this is a stress test of relative decentralization, and I guess we'll push privacy tech to be more decentralized.
So, I mean, with you specifically in Blockstream, I mean, you guys have obviously been building in the open for quite some time now. Does this case change your viewpoint on, I don't know, building on Lightning, Liquid, other layer twos, building on Bitcoin? Like, do you think there'll be more, will we have more pseudonymous devs, more anonymous devs working on these systems? Do you think that's what the trend is going to be?
I mean, I think it would, you know, I've said for a while, I think it would be good if Bitcoin itself had more anonymous developers, because, you know, it's an extra layer of protection. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can. Clearly.
Yeah. Okay, good. You sound choppy to me at times, so I don't know if the audience is experiencing that. So for Lightning itself, I think it's, you know, it's quite decentralized. It's, the infrastructure is operated by individuals, such as it is. I mean, it's all peer-to-peer, and you have self-custody or a reactive security model version of self-custody. You know, for kind of more federated systems or like Liquid, which is, you know, perhaps a bit more geared towards traders and providing an incremental sort of security and confidentiality advantage over transacting on a single centralized exchange, then, you know, you are sort of somewhere in that zone where you're relying on a group of companies, basically. And so that is what it is, but clearly it's, you know, it's a better protection against a centralized failure than trading on a single exchange, which is what many, you know, most people do by volume, right?
So we have Winsome Hacks in the comments saying that the audio sounds good to him. Freaks, definitely, if you're in the comments, keep us updated if the audio becomes an issue. We would appreciate that. So Adam, I mean, so you brought up Liquid. Obviously Liquid is being built out in the open. It's being run. There's the Federation members are all known. There is a privacy component to Liquid with confidential transactions. Has this case changed your viewpoint on Liquid going forward, or, you know, how do you think about that?
Not too much, because, you know, the operators of Liquid are by and large exchanges or entities that are anyway, you know, providing some form of customer facing service, right? And so, you know, there's a possibility from time to time that companies like that could have users that become, you know, targets of different kinds of legal action, right? So that's something that you know, they have.
Now we lost you. I'm not hearing you, Adam. Apologies, freaks, while we wait on Adam to come back in to the room. I am still here. I appreciate you all. Live remote show. This is one of the reasons why I've been trying to do more in the studio, but he's leaving and coming back. And he is back. Hey, Adam, we lost you for a second there.
Yeah. So evidently there was a network problem. It's just that the bandwidth was enough to keep going until it wasn't. So I'm on a different network now. Okay.
No problem at all.
Yeah, so I was just saying,
just drop out and come back in like he did?
Yeah, so what I was saying is that basically with Liquid, many of the network, you know, participants who operate block signers are already providing, you know, basically custodial service in the sense of, you know, if it's operated by a Bitcoin exchange or something like that, right? And so, you know, of course, it's much harder for something like that to happen with Liquid because Liquid is operated by, you know, a dozen, 15 or more different companies in different countries and so forth, right? So it would be procedurally much harder, and the UTXOs in it are not identified in the same way that, you know, the balance of a given exchange account is typically got KYC associated with it and so on.
So, I mean, one concept that I talk about a lot on Dispatch is this idea of trade-offs, particularly between convenience and security, convenience and privacy, convenience and censorship resistance. And, you know, with this Tornado Cash situation specifically, a lot of people have said, okay, you know, we obviously have privacy tools that are used on Bitcoin for collaborative transactions. We have Join Market, which does not have a centralized entity that runs it. But then we also have Whirlpool and Wasabi that use a centralized coordinator. And people say, can't that coordinator be targeted? The way I tend to look at it is, you know, if we're able to use more convenient options that have some kind of centralized element to them that make them more convenient, it behooves us to use those options while we can. But if push comes to shove and we're not able to use those options for whatever reason, we can go towards less convenient, more censorship resistant, more robust options. Is that kind of how you view Liquid, as long as this federation is legally allowed to stand as is, then maybe that's enough and we get this convenience advantage. But if for some reason there are legal challenges or prosecutions or whatnot, then we move to more censorship resistant options instead.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something to be said for sort of the parallel existence of more decentralized and censorship resistant technologies, so that it makes it less interesting for, you know, some organization to try and censor the easy to use thing, because they know ahead of time that, well, people will just switch to this other system. You know, it'll become a little less convenient, but they won't be prevented from their activity. Now, of course, Liquid's, you know, main use case is kind of transacting and limit orders and swaps and things in sort of peer-to-peer non-custodial trades, like on Sideswap and TDEX and BitMatrix and things like that. So you get a bit, so it's more about kind of confidentiality. There's a bit of indirect privacy because every transaction is kind of a bit like a pay join, right? Because there's enhanced ambiguity about, you know, the types of the assets in a transaction and the values of them, where in Bitcoin, because you don't have that confidentiality of being Bitcoin, then, you know, people who are analyzing the chain can draw some inferences from values probably. So you get a bit, but, you know, the primary, you know, people will use the technology for what they find interesting to use it for, right? So there's certainly people using Liquid for all kinds of different things, but I think the main use is these kind of, you know, more decentralized than single exchanges, less custody risk than single exchanges, trade-offs to sort of reduce their single exchange custody risk.
So, I mean, what you were talking about there, just to bring it back for the audience that might be a little bit confused, is Liquid has something that you guys are calling confidential assets, which is on top of confidential transactions. So when you send a transaction, not only is the amount hidden, but also what is being traded is hidden. So if it's Tether, for instance, or if it's Liquid Bitcoin on chain, you can't tell the difference. So if you make a transaction, when we talk about these chain surveillance firms, when you make a transaction, they're essentially doing a probability analysis of whether or not money has changed hands or if someone's sending to themselves. And confidential assets breaks that probability analysis to a degree, at least as more people are using Liquid.
Yeah, I mean, I was a fan of PayJoin, formerly called Pay to Endpoint. And that was something that, you know, Blockstream sort of helped organize a kind of brainstorming hackathon workshop on, and a number of people that were interested in privacy tech, like developers and protocol researchers, came to that. And Pay to Endpoint or PayJoin was the idea that came out of it, which is basically that, I believe BTC PayServer actually implemented it in their wallet as well, and a couple of other wallets did. So the idea is that as part of a transaction, there's a benefit to the recipient to sort of defrag their wallet a bit, i.e. to sort of combine and tidy up their change. And so effectively, they are opportunistically joining some of their UTXOs with a payer's UTXOs, and that makes it a bit more ambiguous about how much is being paid and what's changed and what's not, you know, what's the payment. So I think that's an interesting thing, because it's possible to do that peer-to-peer between two wallets. It actually saves money, you know, so it reduces fees overall over time. And it's, you know, it's an action that nobody can argue about. Like, yes, I want to defrag my wallet, and yes, I want to make payments. And sure, you know, I can have some privacy while doing that.
Right. So in a normal transaction, has inputs and outputs. The inputs are almost always the same individual, the sender. But in a PayJoin, it's a collaborative transaction where the receiver is contributing one or more of the inputs. So that when you're doing the analysis, you can't just assume that all inputs belong to the sender, because it could be a PayJoin, it could be a collaborative transaction. We haven't really seen that much adoption of PayJoin. Why do you think that is?
I think it's kind of, you know, most wallets are pretty busy, you know, keeping up with new developments like Taproot and descriptors. I would like to see, you know, more PayJoin integration. It's something we want to get done in a green wallet as well. I think if you sort of research, it's possible to find like two or three wallets that have it. So, you know, you can sort of vote with your feet by adopting wallets that support it, or adopting kind of self-hosted merchant tech like BTC PayServer that supports it, and making sure the configuration is set up.
Yeah, it seems like there's just a lot of friction there. Also, I mean, from my perspective, it also requires interactivity, right? So you need the receiver to be online to do it. Which works for in-person transactions. I mean, I know Samurai has their own implementation of PayJoin, where essentially, like, if you're already making an in-person payment or a payment with someone you know, presumably they can be online for that payment when they're doing the receiving. And with BTC PayServer, the idea was, if you have this merchant that's already always online with a hot wallet because of Lightning, they could do the same with PayJoin and be ready to do the interactive transaction. It is a little bit disappointing that we haven't seen more uptake of it. Basically, the general concept for the audience is, if we got like 5 or 10% of transactions to be doing this, it basically provides cover for the remainder, because these surveillance firms can't can no longer assume for any transaction that the inputs all belong to the sender, because the transactions, by and far the most, for the most part, will look like a normal transaction. Like, there's not a clear distinction on chain like you see with other collaborative transaction types like CoinJoin.
Right.
So before we move on from Liquid, you guys just recently announced XDEX. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's another kind of non-custodial exchange tech. So basically with Liquid, you can, well, let's back up a bit. So with a Bitcoin transaction, there's a simple rule that the inputs have to add up to the outputs plus the change. And on Liquid, that's extended a bit. So, you know, you can have different types of assets coming in. You could have some Tether coming into a transaction and some Bitcoin coming into a transaction. And the rule is that the inputs of each type have to add up. And so a consequence of that is it's relatively straightforward to make a atomic trade and actually to place a limit order. So, you know, even with a hardware wallet, you could approve a transaction and the keys never left your hardware wallet. And nevertheless, you've got a limit order on a kind of decentralized order book or even a centralized order book, but one that doesn't have custody of your assets. And there are a few variants of that. One is the TDEX, and XDEX is a, so TDEX is a Liquid wallet and a Bitcoin wallet, and it has peg-ins and, you know, so XDEX is them and a decentralized exchange system. Another one is Sideswap, and BitMatrix is an automated market maker concept, which is using similar tech. So that's what that's about. And basically the way that works is you know, if you wanted to sell a Bitcoin for $19,000, you would put one Bitcoin into the transaction and send the change to yourself. And then you would put your own Liquid address to receive 19,000 Tether out, and you'd sign that part of the transaction with the right sig hash. And then you give it, you know, either broadcast it in a decentralized exchange network, sort of peer-to-peer network, or you give it to a sort of bulletin board that manages an order book. And then anybody can take it. All they have to do to take it is put enough Tether in. So it's kind of anyone can spend if you pay. And so that gives you the effect that you can actually place, you know, even out of the market limit orders and just leave them sitting there. And, you know, if somebody pays for the price, then you know, the trade happens and it appears in your software or hardware wallet. And if they don't, it just stays there. And if you want to cancel it, you either rely on the centralized kind of order book manager, or you double spend yourself to robustly get rid of the transaction.
So, I mean, to compare that to something like Shapeshift or Sideshift, .ai, those platforms that allow you to basically go to a website and trade one asset for another asset, they're custodial in nature. You're essentially trusting the centralized entity to hold your funds in that interim period. Like, the transfers go through pretty quickly if it works. If everything goes according to what they say it's going to happen, but you have a moment of custodial risk. With this setup, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is you're trusting the centralized entity to basically coordinate and matchmake, but you're not trusting them with custody of the funds, correct?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's the way, I mean, the private keys for the coins stay in your software or hardware wallet. And the infrastructure to match the trace of XDEX, TDEX, or centralized in the case of Sideswap. Now, Sideswap is also a kind of mobile app and a desktop app. But because the order book is non-custodial, it's much easier for them to operate it without, you know, with simpler licensing or no licensing.
Right. So, like, to bring it back again, so like if you had like an outstanding limit order on Bitfinex while you're waiting for that order to get hit, you have custodial risk. But in this case, you could have an outstanding limit order if Bitcoin hits a certain price without actually putting anything up for custodial risk.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's a little, you know, if you're trading, you've also got to think about how long you're exposed, right? So, you know, if it's an immediate swap, like, yeah, I want to sell at the current market price and swap some Bitcoin for Tether, and you do that on Sideswap or Shapeshift, your exposure, like how many minutes your custody exposed, probably under a minute, right? It's like pretty fast. But with these limit orders, they could sit there for weeks or months, right? And so then people start to get nervous to think, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't put the coins in exchange in custody risk. I will monitor the price and put that on later if it happens. And so you get this kind of trade-off where the exchange liquidity to sort of be robust against flash crashes is pretty thin, because people don't, you know, there's a point where they think if their trade is unlikely to happen, they don't think it's worth the custody risk. And so the exchange order books, you know, some of them are a bit vulnerable to flash crashes because, you know, where they'll fall below. I think Bitfinex is generally pretty robust because there's a lot of pro traders and bots and market makers and algo traders and stuff that will, you know, arbitrage it against other platforms or make decisions. But some of the more retail exchanges will just flash crash, you know, like 500 or 1,000 below the Bitfinex price. And that's partly because people can't leave, you know, they don't want to leave out of the money limit orders on there because they're worried about custody risk. And so I think this could help, you know, as well as reduce the risk of something like Quadriga happening to you, you know, which you never know, right? Ultimately,
right.
Even if exchanges, you know, not doing something untoward like Quadriga did, they can always get, you know, there's always a small risk that they get hacked or an insider hacks them or something. So this kind of largely takes that out.
They get shut down by a regulator or something like that.
Right. I mean, that's happened too. I think BTCE may have had that problem. The regulators seized the exchange at some point.
Yeah, they stormed his vacation house in Greece and they drove an undercover car through the gate and he walked out in his robe while he was still signed into his computer and they seized everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it's obvious, it seems pretty obvious to most people watching Liquid development that, you know, Liquid has not really gotten much adoption. Do you think things like XDEX will increase that adoption? Like what do you think is the reason why so few people seem to be using Liquid right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's somewhere in the region of, you know, Lightning by value, but not by volume. So Bitfinex published some data, where they have both Liquid and Lightning integration, to say that the, you know, the volume was similar, but the average Liquid transaction, like the Liquid deposit or withdrawal, was larger than the average on-chain Bitcoin one, and whereas the Lightning ones was on average much smaller. So I guess that says something about, you know, people are interested to hide values when they're doing larger things, perhaps. And these decentralized order book technologies are relatively recent. So Sideswap, you know, got kind of dropped on the market last year. It's not something we were aware that was in development, but, you know, they released this thing and it had the trustless limit orders in it, which is pretty cool. And, you know, they're continuing to innovate on that to make it more convenient. They've recently added desktop support. So I think that the technologies are reaching maturity, and, you know, there's a potential for, you know, an existing custodial exchange to mix these type of orders, right? Because they could be the maker or taker against a trustless trade from their online order book as well. So I think, you know, one way to look at it is, once it's available on a platform where you can switch to a platform that has reasonable liquidity and market making, you know, basically, why would you go back? Because the custody risk is something that, you know, worries most traders, or it should. And so, you know, if you can get the same kind of service for the types of trades you do without having that, and particularly if it has, you know, hardware wallet integration, that's a pretty nice situation.
So, I mean, I guess to be 100% clear here, using Liquid rather than using on-chain Bitcoin or using Lightning brings additional custodial risk to the end user, because if you use Liquid, there is an element of custodial risk. It's just minimized because it's a federation. It's essentially can be treated as like a multi-sig custodian. But if you look at it from a trader perspective, their current option is a purely custodial platform with a single custodian. So they have a strong incentive, a strong advantage to move over to Liquid tools, because that custodial risk is greatly reduced and they have additional privacy. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's I agree with that. I mean, it's clearly a significant incremental improvement for a trader, because, you know, for something to, you know, impact their coins would require cooperation from lots of services globally, you know, some threshold of them. Now, I think there's also something subtle about custody versus, you know, some kind of automated peg. And so usually when people talk about custody, they're thinking about, you know, something with human discretion and identity and stuff involved, right? Where with Liquid, even though it's, you know, it's, you've got something like Lightning, which is automated, and you know, people are running nodes, you can create a Lightning channel and you can close down a Lightning channel and so on. In Liquid, you've got the peg, and even though the peg is not purely software, you know, that HSM has been operated by exchanges in different parts of the world, it's nevertheless unattended, fully automated, and even the operator of it, if they want to override its behavior, they basically have to tamper with the hardware. So it's a kind of different trade-off. It's not as decentralized as Bitcoin, but it is unattended, and that's where that terminology functionary comes from, which is sort of you know, something that sits there and does a task in an automated system.
Got it. That's an interesting point. So we have Aaron Surf in the Matrix chat. He made an interesting point, just to go back to our PayJoin conversation real quick, that if you copy a BTC Pay server payment link and they have PayJoin enabled and you paste into Sparrow, it will automatically use that by default. And he recently changed how that is visible on BTC Pay server side. So it's more visible. So hopefully that will result in more people using it. He also has a question for you, Adam. He wants to know if you think it's practical for people to contribute anonymously if they've already contributed publicly previously.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you just don't want to be too chatty, right? So, I mean, talking about non-technical topics or writing long-form text, I think, is more likely to reveal stylometry. And I guess there is an analogy for coding style, but in a project like Bitcoin, people usually try to fit in with a style of surrounding code anyway. So I think that's plausible. And, you know, you can sort of, I mean, any developer is going to have some kind of developing history, typically some open source history. But it's great if, you know, somebody new to the ecosystem who hasn't written open source code starts that way as well. So I think it's all valuable. And it insulates Bitcoin from, you know, political pressure that could be put on individual developers. I mean, I think ultimately Bitcoin is fairly well insulated from that because, you know, the binaries have to get built from the code. There are lots of people reviewing it, lots of people cross-verifying the deterministic builds. And it's, you know, relatively implausible that a users would refuse to run it if there was something bad. But still, it's good to have, you know, developers who are not impacted or having to be concerned about these kind of issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes back to what we talk about a lot on the show, just in general, that most of this stuff is not black and white. If you can make certain improvements, like contributing anonymously separate, if you've already contributed, from your known legal entity, legal identity, that's still an improvement, even if it's not perfect. That, you know, there are obviously areas where you can make mistakes. Like Adam said, you can compare that to, we've seen that with Satoshi, people trying to unmask Satoshi, going back and going through miscellaneous writing, stuff like that, to try and compare that to other sources of information. So the more information you have out there with your legal identity, the more likely it is that can be attached to your pseudonym. But it's just a net, it's just straight up a net improvement, at least on the plausible deniability side, probably for a lot of these contributors, if they choose to contribute anonymously in addition to contributing publicly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the confidential transactions, I mean, talking about things like PayJoin and CoinJoins in general, one of the interesting properties of confidential transactions, and bear in mind that originally confidential transactions was, I proposed it for Bitcoin as a way to improve privacy in Bitcoin itself. And then I found that, you know, because it's a relatively complicated change, it'd be difficult to get that integrated into Bitcoin. And so I spent, you know, try to find ways to make Bitcoin more modular, which is how we came to be working on sidechains to do that. And so then we were able to get, you know, confidential transactions in the sidechain. But I remain hopeful that eventually the Bitcoin main chain might get consensus to integrate confidential transactions with Bitcoin directly. And the beauty of that for, you know, protocols like PayJoin and CoinJoin is that every join is perfect, because you don't have to worry about, you know, values giving the game away at all, because only visible to the sender and receiver.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm glad you brought this up, because I wanted to bring it up. You had mentioned something similar in our last rip, the epic 3-hour rip, and you mentioned it kind of in the middle, and it's a very controversial topic. And you kind of got a pass on it. I don't know if it was from people missed it or just the fact that you're an absolute legend, so you're allowed to talk about controversial things without people going crazy. But
well, they should critique me, because, you know, that's part of the don't trust verify, right? But well, yeah,
that's what we appreciate about you. But I mean, you said specifically, not only would you like to see confidential transactions on Bitcoin, but you coupled that with another controversial statement, which was not only implement confidential transactions on Bitcoin, but also we could increase the block size as a result, because we'd be less at risk of miner censorship. Do you still stand by that? You'd like to see both happen on Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I would like to see confidential transactions, and of course the downside with confidential transactions is the transactions are a bit bigger because of the range proofs. And so with SegWit, there's, you know, a space reserved for, I mean, it's not a separate data stream, but, you know, there's a different discount for witnesses, i.e. the signatures. And with confidential transactions, you could potentially have a even more discounted witness space for the range proofs. And so that would give you, you know, potentially more data, which, you know, in literal terms is more data transferred per block. But that might be, you know, useful to get people to want to use them, because otherwise what will happen is it will reduce the number of transactions you can get done per block because they're bigger, right? So I think they're sort of a bit interrelated. So that's why. And yeah, I think the argument is, well, as you reminded the audience, you know, the argument would be that, you know, why do we not want too much data? It's so that we avoid the risk of selective censorship coming. And, you know, if there's more privacy, that's another way you avoid selective censorship. It's like, you know, somebody who wants to censor something can't figure out what's going on, so they don't know what to censor. And so that's maybe a bit of a boost to censorship resistance to offset some of the increased data footprint.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to reason that just to bring people back, if you were not around during the 2017 block size wars, the basic premise is the more bandwidth required, the more data being transferred, the more likely miner centralization happens, and we have less distributed miners. And then as a result, if you have less distributed miners and less people being able to use their own node because of higher data requirements, it would result in more censorship, because it'd be, you know, a more centralized system. But if we had, your thought process goes, if we had confidential transactions there, even if mining became slightly more centralized, those centralized miners would not be able to pick transactions to censor because they wouldn't really know what was happening.
Yeah, to a certain extent. And so you could think about that as an offset. And of course, you know, it's a bit of a gray area to argue, you know, which trade-off is, if it's a net win or not, right? So people would have to develop an opinion about that.
And so the main argument against confidential transactions on Bitcoin is that it'd be harder to detect inflation, unknown inflation happening with Bitcoin. What do you say to people that levy that argument?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is it's a valid concern, and it's seen some altcoins with more complicated forms of privacy have near misses in that regard. So now with confidential transactions, there are two versions. One which uses AlcaML commitments, where you mathematically prevent inflation, like inflation is not possible, and Pedersen commitments, where if ultimately, you know, Schnorr signatures were broken in the far future, then inflation could become possible. And that's all excluding, you know, software bugs. But Bitcoin is, you know, the technology for confidential transactions sounds counterintuitive, but actually the building blocks are, you know, basically the same as Schnorr signatures and ECDSA. So it's using quite conservative cryptography assumptions.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the latter, the Pedersen commitment model, is what Monero is using right now, right?
I think so, yeah. And it's actually what Liquid uses as well, coincidentally. And I think that's an okay trade-off for Liquid, because in Liquid, you're not really looking to do cold storage. You're more looking to, you know, place trades that probably won't sit there for too long.
And what's the advantage of using that over the AlcaML version?
I mean, I think the Pedersen commitment version was just developed earlier. The AlcaML observation came a bit later. Also, AlcaML is a little bit bigger, so there's more
data.
Yeah, not just incrementally though. So it's not prohibitive.
So if we were to see confidential transactions on Bitcoin, that would be a hard fork. People need to remember that anyone can fork Bitcoin whenever they want to fork Bitcoin without permission.
I mean, it's a bit of a gray area whether that be a hard fork or not. So Johnson Lau, it was Felix Weiss had proposed a way to soft fork confidential transactions. And it was a bit complicated, but it looked to kind of work. So there are a couple of avenues where it could be soft forked, and then of course it could be done in a slightly simpler way if hard forked. So yeah, maybe it could be soft forked.
Realistically speaking, do you think we will ever see that?
Sure. I mean, I think one other track to simplicity, and that may actually be more attractive to people in a way. So what simplicity is a kind of second generation scripting language, which was designed for Bitcoin and, you know, it's also been worked on for Liquid. And that is lower level and basically brings a security and formal proof focused low level, kind of almost bit or logical level language to Bitcoin in the future, which allows extensibility so that, you know, something like the Schnorr signature could be implemented from scratch. And, you know, it has this concept of JITs, which are kind of access to lots of lower level libraries. So the actual implementation of something like Schnorr remains remarkably compact. And so the point there is something like simplicity would probably allow, you know, enough extensibility that confidential transactions could be implemented as well as, you know, covenants and many other things that people might want to try. And so, you know, now of course this is all some distance away. Simplicity is not in liquid yet, but we're hoping to get it there later this year so people can try it out. And so eventually I think simplicity is potentially the best option for ossification of Bitcoin, because, you know, it enables this extensibility. So it could be the last soft fork sort of thing, right? And so that might be an easier topic for people to get consensus on, is basically introducing security and formal proof focused extensibility into Bitcoin.
And so, like, what would that look like in practice? It would look like you'd basically have the option of using confidential transactions or the option not to.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's anything you build. I mean, simplicity is, you know, very conceptually similar in terms of, you know, UTXO organization. It's soft forkable itself as a new TAP script or SegWit version. And it just has a different encoding and a low level implementation. So, and then the Bitcoin wallets tend to have the form where the recipient is going to choose, you know, his own spending script, and the sender may not even know what it is, right? Because it could be hashed. And so, you know, if users want to opt into some scheme that requires both sender and recipient, then that's going to work between them. And people who don't have that will, you know, they'll get a non-confidential output, which is possible with confidential transactions. You can mix confidential and non-confidential.
That's interesting. So we have Orange Surf again in the Matrix chat asking, would CT implemented using simplicity result in very large scripts?
Maybe not so large, because you would be relying on JITs, which are kind of library calls to, you know, big number libraries, big arithmetic operations. And so at the highest level, if basically all you're doing is gluing together, you know, hashing and big number operations and elliptic curve not apply and things like that, then the program is quite small at that point. And it is kind of log scaled. So if there's anything repetitive about it, it gets generally smaller by log scale.
Got it. But there would be, in practice, there would be, if you were using confidential transactions in this way, you'd be paying higher fees than if you were just doing a regular Bitcoin transaction.
Yeah. I mean, that is something, you know, some people have talked about, the concept of whether, you know, that, I mean, that's just a side effect of people using different transactions that applies today. But the, you know, in the specific context of confidential transactions, some people have offered the opinion that, you know, the fee should be the same whether you use it or not, to encourage people to use it, because you get more privacy and confidentiality if everybody's using it. And if there's no financial, you know, if the fees aren't higher for using it, then you might as well use it, kind of thing, right?
Right. There's two trains of thought. It's make, if you make privacy cheaper, then more people will use it. But if you can make it at least the same cost, then also
right,
more people will use yep. it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So, I mean, just to put you on the spot here, 10 years using Bitcoin with confidential transactions, how likely is that percentage wise? Is it greater than 50% in your mind?
Yeah, maybe that would be around that range. I mean, 10 years is you know, in Bitcoin development, it's very methodical, and it takes some years for features from Liquid. And this has happened before in a sense that Liquid had Schnorr signatures, well, Elements, the open source part of Liquid, the base that it's implemented in, had SegWit and Schnorr signatures in the past. And, you know, that itself took, I don't know, what, 5 years or something until, you know, there was a concrete proposal. And the version that Bitcoin has is actually improved and fixes some limitations with that early version. So I think Liquid has shown itself useful as a kind of test bed in a way for live value and new features. So possibly, you know, I mean, I think if simplicity is palatable and interesting to people and people get confidence in the security assurances that it provides, then, you know, a lot of things become possible to innovate on faster in a permissionless way.
So the way I kind of look at it is, you know, Bitcoin, one of the main value props of Bitcoin is that it is extremely hard to change. And as a result, for changes to happen, there needs to be like a groundswell of support. There needs to be overwhelming support for a change to happen. And it's hard to measure that overwhelming support. But when I look at, you know, the privacy situation with Bitcoin, obviously it's a major focus of this show and my time. I kind of view it as if we start to see, which I expect, if we start to see more state attacks on individuals, you know, Bitcoin is very robust at the protocol level against states, but at the individual level, there's a lot of privacy vulnerabilities of people getting pressured. If we start to see more of that happen, then all of a sudden there will be more support and more momentum to improve Bitcoin privacy guarantees. Would you agree on that thesis?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you certainly see that with the sort of the way that Bitcoin, the human part of Bitcoin anti-fragility works. You know, for example, that after the big block situation, you know, the big block debate drama was resolved, you saw since that point a lot more initiatives towards running full nodes, education about that, improved ease of doing that, and a kind of whole push to do that. And I think that was sort of in part reactive. Like, you know, if you verify with your own node, then you're much better protected against unwanted protocol changes. So I do think the system learns, and the anti-fragility is people, you know, adopting tech and pushing for, you know, educating the wider community to adopt things and change things. So yeah, I mean,
and then more robust as a result.
Yeah.
Just to change gears here a little bit, since you were last on, you know, Blockstream has provided open source funding to this new concept, originally called Minimint, and now it's called Fediment. Since then, a for-profit company has also been spun up called Fedi. That is kind of leading the charge here in terms of development and rollout to users. They expect to have a wallet in people's hands by the end of the year, maybe early January. What are your thoughts on Fediment as a concept?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and it has, you know, led to some different trade-offs being considered that hadn't been really contemplated before. So the original idea with the federated Chorn Mint was this kind of a big, very private, you know, in terms of privacy, Bitcoin denominated utility coin. And so we'd contemplated at Blockstream, you know, the basically based, being able to redeem it for Blockstream, you know, swag and services like data on a satellite, buying t-shirts, buying hardware wallets, especially buying mining. And of course, because it's peer-to-peer and respendable, people could use it for other website integrations and things like that. So we'd approached it from that point of view originally, which is a little bit more centralized and has a clear trust story, which is, well, you know, as long as Blockstream honors the selling them to you, you could sort of reuse them, gift them, and potentially redeem them. But since, and there was a prototype of that that Greg Maxwell had implemented, I think, around about 2015, 2016, something like that. And, but that was just at the kind of library level. So since the sort of refresh of that idea and Eric working with our, you know, in our research team to build the, you know, to tie it to the Federation, I mean, the original one was just library level, but to make it work concretely, you have to have the coordination mechanism for a Federation to kind of have a group of people, a group of nodes sign it. So it's a bit of like coordination glue, and that coincidentally is the same kind of logic that Liquid uses, right? So to coordinate block signatures and things like that. So there's a bit of overlapping tech there. And then arose the idea that communities of people could run the nodes, which is a kind of new concept. And of course that has its own trade-offs, but it's nevertheless quite interesting, new experimental kind of trust model, if you like.
And I mean, a key aspect of the Federman proposal is that they're interoperable with each other. All the different Federmans are interoperable with each other using Lightning.
Yeah.
Do you like that? Has obviously been a, you know, going in and out of Liquid has been a pain point, I think, in Liquid adoption. Do you think Federman might find greater success because of that interoperability built in?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of gluing things together with Lightning is quite interesting because a starting point, the eCash tokens on different Federmans would be, you know, incompatible and not directly acceptable. But then you get a kind of, you know, arbitrage or exchange process where different Federmans can accept Lightning deposits and withdrawals, and that becomes a rapid way to do that. I think another interesting potential, which has been less discussed, but is something that people were chatting about during the Baltic Honey Badger conference last weekend, is the idea that the a Federmint Federation, you know, it's issuing eCash coins with privacy from a Federation, that those could potentially be simultaneously issued into Liquid as an issued asset. And, you know, that the Federmint Federation could sort of offer to convert between, you know, a Liquid issued asset and an eCash coin. And so those could become, you know, it could become another kind of connecting technology. So you can move assets backwards and forwards using Lightning or using Liquid. And, you know, to put that in context, and another kind of design aspect of Liquid, which is probably less well known, is that there are two functions which are separable. So there's the Federation that is signing the blocks with a multisig and the HSMs, and then there's another Federation which is managing the PEG wallet. And in principle, they could be different Federations. Today's Liquid configuration, they're the same Federation, right? And so the idea here is that you could actually have multiple pegs and they could be managed with that same code, or they could be managed in a different way, you know, the same code in the HSMs, or they could be managed in a different way where, you know, a given Federmint just issues Liquid tokens which represent a claim on the Bitcoins that it has in its multi-sig wallet spread across the Federation. So that would be an interesting additional kind of two network visibility of the same kind of issuer coins that are backed by Bitcoin, and also a way to use the kind of decentralized order books we were talking about, like Sideswap, and you swap Liquid Bitcoin for some of these wallets. Like TDEX has actually the ability to do a trustless peg-in, so you can like peg Bitcoin into Liquid Bitcoin, and Sideswap has a way to swap Bitcoin and Liquid Bitcoin bidirectionally as well.
In practice, Federman wallets could be a convenient and relatively private way of moving back and forth from Liquid and Lightning or on-chain Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, you know, interesting to see interoperability and new configurations arise. Because, you know, it could be convenient to different people. For example, what Bitfinex reported about the typical transaction sizes on Lightning versus Liquid versus main chain, that, you know, they saw larger transactions on Liquid, medium size on Bitcoin, and small on Lightning. So that could allow, you know, different size of transactions to transact, perhaps, where it might push the limits of Lightning liquidity, let's say.
So, I mean, the major trade-off with Fediment wallets will be essentially custodial risk. Now, that custodial risk is attempted to be minimized because ideally multi-sig custodians will be used. So you'll need a quorum. You need a majority of those federation members to get a rug pull or to have them exit scam and take your money. But also at the same time, if you have that majority, they can inflate the supply of the eCash tokens, the internal tokens, right, within the Fediment wallets, which is almost, it's like a more quiet rug pull. What do you say to people that say that the Fediment design is dead on arrival for that trade-off?
I mean, it is a trade-off. I mean, I think it has some advantages as well as having that trade-off. So one is that, you know, the reason that you articulated that it could suffer from inflation is a side effect of the privacy and the fact that this kind of, it's not really a blockchain, right? So it's not auditable. It's to do with the unlinkability of the eCash coins. Of course, you do get the benefit of the federation, so you have to have high degree of collusion before that could happen. I think some things could be done to harden it. So we've been interested for a while to provide liquid functionary hardware to developers as a kind of programmable HSM. And with that, you could use some extra features. You could use a tamper resistance. Some of these chipsets have TPM remote attestation. So it's basically a way to provide sort of hardware-assisted assurance of what code is actually running on the HSM. I know it's a bit of a foreign concept for people that, you know, a distributed thing could be running HSMs, but why not? You know, I mean, effectively, something like the cold card auto signer is a kind of HSM that you can buy, you know, a very small one, and implement things on. So I think that, and actually, you know, Intel and ARM chips have some basic kind of TPM security functions on them. So, you know, you can make use of them additively.
Right. So, I mean, that trade-off can't be removed completely, but the risk could be mitigated to a degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, the other context is, you know, people have looked at Lightning versus Liquid and, you know, sort of Lightning is kind of bearer self-custody. You're not trusting any other parties, right? But on that, so that's on the kind of trust dimension, but on the security dimension, you're ultimately running a hot wallet, right? Where I think Liquid has arguably better security assurances but lower trust assurances. So there's some kind of trade-off in different dimensions. And so it really ultimately depends what you're doing. And, you know, you can get some of those benefits of hardening from for Fediment too. But yeah, I think you need to pay a bit of attention as to who's operating the federation. Now, in the case of Liquid, it's clear it's an identified set of companies effectively, right, where, you know, they are in the sort of providing exchange service typically, right? So, you know, they wouldn't want to exit scam because it would impact their main business. Where with a Fediment, you know, if it's, you know, people trusted in the community, there's a risk that somebody from outside the community might trust the wrong person or something.
Right. I mean, I expect there'll be many different federation models using Fediment. Some will be public, some will be anons, some will be small community leadership, some will be a combination of the above, and users will essentially choose what they prefer.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking it might be interesting for a kind of hybrid between companies and individuals, but not too many companies. So that the companies in isolation couldn't freeze funds, basically. And then they could provide a bit of security assurance without being a freeze risk.
I mean, you could actually set it up so the individuals couldn't collude on their own either. They would need companies. So then both subsets of entities couldn't do it without someone from the other side defecting.
Yeah. So maybe you could get a bit of, I mean, I think you need one to be larger to override the other, right? Because, you know, if companies wanted to freeze things, then the end user, right, power user type of user nodes need to be able to override them. And that means that, you know, they can still access GAN, but it's just harder because they have to reach a higher threshold.
In general, would you agree with the premise that the ideal situation is that Bitcoiners have many different tools with many different trade-offs, and they're able to choose which tools fit their needs best?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's certainly desirable. And I think one observation which, I learned over the years, and we found out, you know, saw repeated at Blockstream, is that you learn by doing, in the sense that, you know, we build something now and it improves our understanding of the system behavior and sometimes leads to ideas that were not previously known of how to improve them. So, you know, I think, for example, with confidential transactions, Greg Maxwell and myself tried to size optimize it to make the branch proof smaller. And then ultimately, Peter and Greg went to see, you know, Dan Bonet, one of the academic crypto researchers in the Bay Area, a university there, and, you know, explained the problem statement. And out of that conversation and collaboration, ultimately came Bulletproofs, which was a lot more, you know, and something that people hadn't envisaged, which was, you know, a kind of snark-like construct, but using the same kind of, you know, conservative and simple security assumptions that Bitcoin uses. So, you know, I think by building things and trying things, we might arrive at something beyond, you know, that's more than the sum of the parts, right? So, right. Yeah, this has got some trade-offs, but now that we're looking at the trade-offs closer and thinking about them in a different way, maybe ultimately we make, you know, a new leap, or we see more end-user adoption and programming around TPMs, which are, you know, even the technology's been around, they haven't been that widely used for peer-to-peer security protocols, for example.
That makes sense to me. Okay, let's change gears again. To people who haven't been paying attention, it might not be obvious to them, but I have noticed that Blockstream, y'all at Blockstream, have gone pretty hard into mining. You're almost a Bitcoin mining company first now. You want to talk a little bit? I mean, you recently, I don't even know when it happened. Maybe it happened a year ago. You guys acquired Spoondoolies, an ASIC manufacturer. What is the strategy over at Blockstream with mining?
So, I mean, generally we've been focused on, you know, decentralization, privacy, and sort of defending, hardening, and improving Bitcoin. And actually, from the initial launch of the company in 2014, we were already intending to do something. I thought about how improved my would be, you know, if every ecosystem company that's doing things related to Bitcoin, payment processing, exchange, wallets, etc., did a bit of mining, then mining would be more decentralized. And, you know, we started doing that after some time, and then expanded that to providing hosting to other companies, which is, you know, has been a growth area for us over the last few years, to the point that we're managing, you know, quite a lot of megawatts. In fact, you know, more than some public mining companies, even though we're a private company, so we don't disclose the actual data. And so one of the obvious areas of concern, which has been escalated by, you know, the final actual attempted ban of mining in China, you know, there were threats of that for many years, but finally something actually happened that, you know, visibly moved the hash rate and saw relocation of equipment, is that China became a little bit more hostile to Bitcoin, or specifically to Bitcoin mining. And yet many of the, so almost most of the equipment that people are mining with is actually, you know, the boards are manufactured and assembled in China by Chinese companies, right? So there's a little bit more of a geopolitical risk there. And also just for, you know, diversification, it would be good to have a miner manufactured more internationally. And so we'd actually mined some of Spondylus equipment, you know, back some years ago, and quite liked it. It's kind of a rack mount form factor, high build quality. So different form factor, kind of more data center, and fitting in standard racks, that kind of outlook. And so we got the opportunity with the B round Q3 last year to bring them into the Blockstream fold, and they've been working on, you know, doing their thing and making an ASIC, making a miner. So that's something that's ongoing, and we hope to have, you know, more progress on that we can talk about going into next year.
But you guys plan on releasing your own ASIC?
Yeah. I mean, actually the whole system, you know, the ASIC, the finished miner, and then the control boards, everything that goes into that. Of course, we favor the open source approach, quite like what Brains has been doing with the open firmware. So we probably look to collaborate with them on that.
That's exciting. I'm looking forward to what you guys build there. So, I mean, on the mining front, I've been going down this thought experiment with a lot of my Bitcoin buddies. And I'm curious on your opinion, since I have you. In 50 years, just to put you on the spot, what do you think the total percent of energy consumption in the world will be dedicated to Bitcoin mining? Out of total energy consumption, what percent will go towards Bitcoin mining in your mind? Just a rough estimate. We're not going to hold you to it in 50 years.
It's hard to project that far forward, but I think it's certainly a lot less than what people would assume, because it's a, you know, it's a commodity economic situation. So if people push up the hash rate too much, the profitability drops and the hash rate drops. So it's in a kind of equilibrium. And of course the you know, the halvings are happening over that kind of time period would start to reduce the number of coins mined quite a lot as that exponentially reduces. And then the final thing, which is kind of the big area of unknown, is, you know, what is the top of the S curve? You know, how much of global monetary use does Bitcoin capture, right? Do we end up in the safety in a moose situation with a new gold standard being Bitcoin? But I think even in that case, you know, which in today's money is, you know, in the several hundred trillion dollar range, you can estimate, you know, based on future difficulty, many halvings in the future and that kind of price point, that it's quite practical. And I think the other point is that, you know, typically civilization grows along increased power. So wealthier countries have more available power, and, you know, wealth generation is correlated with access to power and, you know, types of power. So I've the future is, you know, a future where humanity will develop a lot more power resources from various sources, whether that's, you know, nuclear fusion in the future, solar, wind, hydro. You know, there's an enormous amount of underused power in the world. And, you know, I mean, actually, to give an example of kind of underutilized power, we have one data center in Montreal, Canada, and that the Quebec province of Canada has a lot of hydro resources. I think it's something like 65 hydro dams, and most of that power is unused. And there's actually enough unused hydropower that's, you know, connected to the grid and ready to use that could power the entire Bitcoin network just out of the unused power. So, you know, of course, there are lots more hydro resources globally, both constructed and, you know, untapped. So even on the hydro side, there's a lot of upside. And of course, I think Bitcoin is a great vehicle for providing the sort of business fundamentals to fund building more power infrastructure to kind of drive economic growth for the future.
So, Adam, I mean, I appreciate your deliberate and insightful answer there, but I'm going to have to put you on the spot. Do you think it's going to be less than 5% or more than 5%?
Less than 5%.
Interesting. Okay, well, we'll readdress this in 50 years and we'll see. We'll see how close you were.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting, it's just a really interesting thought process, because you see like the Elizabeth Warrens of the world. A lot of the anti-Bitcoin, anti-proof of work people say that, you know, Bitcoin is going to consume a lot of energy. But then you talk to some of the most bullish Bitcoiners, particularly in the mining space, and they almost uniformly say under 5%.
Yep.
So there's a massive disconnect there. I just feel like, yeah, it's interesting.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, as you see in the Quebec province of Canada, right, that government policy is often misaligned with their stated intent. So, you know, it's hard for governments to operate as efficiently as a free market. And, you know, so they're foregoing, you know, economic activity for the Quebec province in the tune of billions of dollars per year, because they're choosing not to sell power. That's, you know, so it's extremely hot, almost entirely hydro, right? So it's
right,
pretty much neutral environmentally, because the heat is dissipated anyway, because they just open up the sluice gates and pour it downstream on all these dams, right? So, you know, I think that is, you know, a source of economic wealth that could, you know, be used to further expand power infrastructure, increase employment, bring wealth and jobs to the region. And so, you know, I think ultimately those jobs go to other regions. That's how things evolve.
Yeah, I mean, I guess from my thought process, why it might be higher than 5% is, you know, Darren Feinstein of Core Scientific released some stats on wasted energy and lost energy in America specifically. And it was significantly more than 50% is lost or wasted. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I feel like Bitcoin eats a lot of that waste, because it provides a direct financial incentive. So I do wonder, like in the commoditization of ASICs, when ASICs have much larger life cycles, they're easy to acquire, they're incorporated in a bunch of different things that we use on a day-to-day basis. Specifically in my mind, I'm constantly thinking about like water heaters and you know, water heaters, heating your home, stuff like that. I feel like Bitcoin will dominate a lot of that current waste that's happening, because there's a direct financial incentive. So that's kind of where I come from when I think it could be higher. But I guess we'll see. We'll find out.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the waste is because some types of power source are slow to start and stop, and then you've got an excess that you can't, you know, that people get paid negative power rates to get rid of,
right?
You know, put space heaters outside and heat the environment with, or something. Or burn off, you know, gas and things like that, which is not so great for the environment. And so, yeah, some of the other power sources don't have that problem. Like they're faster to spin up and down. So maybe that's an evolving thing too.
I have another question for you from the chat, from the Matrix chat. This comes from Communer. He was wondering if you've ever read the book Mandibles.
I have not.
Mandibles is a book that I've been talking a lot about because it goes through a hypothetical situation of the U.S. going through a hyperinflation event. And there's just a lot of similarities to what we're seeing today. But I encourage all the freaks to give it a read. It's an interesting thought process. And you, Adam, I mean, I don't know, you're a busy man, so maybe the audiobook.
All right.
I just want to thank you for joining us. I know time is scarce, and I really do appreciate your thoughts, and I mean, I appreciate all your contributions to the space. You really are you're just an amazing human being, and we really do appreciate you. I think I speak for all the freaks. I like to end this show with final thoughts from our guests. So Adam, you have any final thoughts for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Bitcoin's drive for progress is basically kind of like the anti-fragility, right? So it's the kind of combined enthusiasm and energy of all of the Bitcoiners. So I think, you know, we're going to win, basically, because it's like the, you know, the mind virus that captures everybody's imagination and pulls more and more people in. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, of course the price is volatile, but that's, you know, that's a short-term thing. In the long term, the adoption is doing, and a lot of the adoption metrics are, you know, still pretty impressive over the last year even.
I love that as final thoughts. We are going to win. We're going to win, freaks. And it's an honor and privilege to be a part of this movement with all of you and Adam. I just want to thank Adam again for joining us. I want to thank all the freaks who joined us in the live chat. You guys make this show truly unique. I want to thank all the freaks who continue to support the show, whether that's through sats, direct financial support, or whether that's through subscribing to the show on your favorite platform, leaving a review, sharing with friends. It really is appreciated, and I couldn't do it without all of you. With all that said, cheers, stay humble, and stack sats. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.